Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 346 for December 4th, 2011. Support for Whiskey Cask comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. Coming up in a few minutes...
We maniacs, we do things in a slightly different way.
That's Keith Wood of the Malt Maniacs. The 1st of December always means the announcement of the annual Malt Maniacs Whiskey Awards. This year, 171 whiskeys from around the world were entered. Just 8 won gold medals. Keith and fellow maniac Krishna Nukala will discuss this year's winners with me later on. I'll also have the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. When I was at Woodford Reserve in Kentucky a few weeks ago with some other whiskey writers for the debut of this year's Master's Collection Rye Whiskies, Chris Morris had something else to show us, but only if we agreed to not say anything until December 1st. We did, and on Thursday, I was able to break the news on the Facebook page about Woodford Reserve Double Oaked.
It's the first full-time permanent member of the family beyond Woodford Reserve Distiller Select.
What makes this one unique? I know you showed me some of the toasting process, at least what you could show that's not proprietary, when we were back in Louisville and back in Versailles a couple few weeks ago. But what makes this one unique?
Well, it's really special, Mark. First of all, we operate under the assumption that Woodford is special. And part of the special character of Woodford is the fact, as you well know, and hopefully your listeners know, that our parent company, Brown-Forman, is the only whiskey company in the world that makes its own barrels. We have a cooperage in Louisville, the Brown-Forman Cooperage. And it makes barrels specifically for each of our brands. So the Woodford Reserve barrel is unique among all whiskey barrels of the world. And what makes it unique is it's crafted from wood that is seasoned out of doors for a minimum of 9 months. And then it has a toast prior to charring, and no other whiskey barrel has that, in three different steps. So the barrel is unique to begin with. That's the first barrel, the Woodford Reserve Distiller Select barrel. Once we have Woodford Reserve fully mature, we empty barrels together, 100 barrels at a time, batching them together to create our consistent Woodford Reserve Distiller Select profile. And then we re-barrel that batch at 110 proof into a second barrel, the double barrel. And this barrel in itself is unique, crafted specifically for double oaked. It's not the Woodford Reserve barrel, it's the double oaked barrel. And it has the 9 month seasoned wood. The toast is over twice as long as the Distiller Select toast. And then the char is just a kiss of flame, 5 second char, which is the least in the industry, making this technically a bourbon barrel, but we aren't looking for the classic bourbon notes. We're looking for those very special toasted oak notes. The spirit matures for an additional year in the second barrel, and that gives us this absolutely special whiskey.
And this will go on sale after the holidays, of course, but how much of it will be available at first, and where will it be available?
Well, it is going to be, even though it's a permanent member of the family, so that means it's a new standard SKU, 750 mil only. We will have only 10,000 cases a year, so it will be dear. I don't know where, in terms of markets, it will end up, because I'm sure there will be an allocation process involved, but I would expect to find it at the finer bars, restaurants, and package stores across the country.
How much of the research that went into creating the special double-oaked barrel came out of the Master's Collection? This sounds an awful lot like the wine barrels you guys experimented with a while back.
Well, it does have its origins in the continuing research that creates the unique master's collection release each year. So this has its roots in a couple of projects, definitely in the Seasoned Oak Finish project, and also, as you mentioned, in the Sonoma Goutreur project. So we've learned the qualities of toasting barrels, which are the practices of our great American wine industry, especially when you consider Chardonnays, the classic California Chards, Washington State and Oregon, and the Seasoned Oak, of course, in rebarreling in a bourbon barrel, a toasted and charred barrel in our case. So we were learning a lot going back a number of years. So this process, this project has had many years under its belt before it's seen the light of day.
Give me the taste differences between the double oaked barrel and the standard distiller's select barrel, because I know that just putting that little barest minimum of char into it really lets the wood get in a little further into the toasted part and bring out some of those elements, right?
It sure does. The product is much darker than Woodford Reserve, as you would expect, and so visually you see the difference. It's very much a richer color, and Woodford Reserve itself is an absolutely rich colored bourbon. And on the nose, you can definitely pick up more honeycomb, more spice. It's a more visceral experience just through the sense of smell. And then when you taste, it is very creamy, very smooth. It's presented at the same proof of Distiller Select at 90.4, and it is much, much smoother and calmer on the palate. And, of course, rich oak character, once again, some nice fruit, more honeycomb, more vanilla. It's just more flavorful, more creamy. It is a discernibly more elegant product.
Which one do you prefer, Distiller Select or Double Oaked?
Ooh. Well, you know, I've always said Woodford Reserve is the best bourbon ever created until this came along. So it's going to have to be Double Oaked.
And coming from you, that's high praise indeed if you created something even better than Woodford.
I think it's really going to turn people on. It's unbelievable.
Is this something that realistically could have been done years ago if distillers hadn't insisted on that heavy level of charring in barrels?
Well, it certainly could have been. But without the toasting process, a very lightly charred barrel wouldn't give you much. We're really charring the barrel at the barest minimum levels simply because it is technically a bourbon barrel. It's this unique toasting process that I'm so glad you were able to join us and get a glimpse of that has really given us these special characteristics. And because of the time involved and the expense involved, it's something that no bourbon has ever been willing to do before.
I don't generally do tasting notes or scores on pre-release samples, but if the final product lives up to the sample I tried in October, this is going to be a great bourbon. I'll post tasting notes on the WhiskeyCast website after I've tried the final version. In other news, Diageo has opened a new $15 million cooperage at Cambus in Scotland's Fife region. It'll handle the work of assembling and repairing casks for Diageo's 28 distilleries in Scotland. The cooperage has more than 100 workers, including 8 apprentices and a new custom-designed coopering school at the complex. Scotch whiskey exports for the first 3 quarters of the year hit a new record. According to the Scotch Whiskey Association, exports between January and September gained 23% over a year ago, with the U.S. remaining the largest export market by value and France the largest market by volume. In other SWA news, Diageo's Paul Walsh has stepped aside as the association's chairman after 4 years in office. Ian Curley of the Edrington Group is the new chairman. Pernod Ricard CEO Pierre Pringuet becomes vice chairman. Last month, I mentioned the auction of a special bottle of Benromic to benefit the Murray Inshore Rescue Organization on Scotland's Murray Firth. The bottle was signed by distillery manager Keith Cruikshank and fellow malt maniac and blogger Ralphie Mitchell, who hand-filled it during a recent visit to the distillery. The auction is over. It raised 500 pounds, or nearly $800, for the local rescue group. Let's talk about new whiskeys now. We'll start with Japan. Suntory is releasing a 50-year-old Yamazaki single malt aged in Mizunara oak casks. Just 150 bottles will be available in Japan at almost $13,000 each. It's only the third time Suntory has released a 50-year-old Yamazaki. The previous releases came in 2005 and 2007. It's not quite as old or quite as rare, but Master of Malt has released the fourth edition of its 30-year-old Speyside single malt. The whiskey comes from an undisclosed distillery in Speyside and was matured in sherry casks. It's bottled at 40% ABV and will sell for around £100 or $155 a bottle. By the way, Master of Malt has also released a new whiskey liqueur based on a 55-year-old single malt, again from an undisclosed Speyside distillery. Now, this is my own personal guess. Presumably, the whiskey wasn't quite good enough to bottle on its own as a single malt without a little help from sugar and spices to make it a liqueur. It's billed as the world's oldest whiskey liqueur. It'll sell for around £1,000 a bottle. Let's go from old to young now. In Ireland, unaged whiskey is called poteen, and Cooley Distillery is releasing its first ever poteen. It's triple distilled in pot stills from a mash of malted and unmalted barley and bottled at a whopping 65% ABV. 1,800 bottles will be available through the Celtic Whiskey Shop in Dublin and the duty-free shops at Dublin Airport. West Virginia's Smooth Ambler Distillery has a white whiskey on the market and will be releasing its own bourbons in early 2012, but has uncovered some unique bourbon casks and is bottling them as Old Scout Bourbon, a 5-year-old high rye content bourbon bottled at 49.5% ABV or 99 proof. Smooth Ambler's John Little told me Old Scout's name underscores its heritage.
We've been trying to find a whiskey that we could be really proud of for a while and be sort of it's something that we could bring to market right away. So we went through about maybe found a couple of people who could help us locate bourbon. We found went through maybe 12 bourbons before we found the one that before we found Old Scout, and we bought about 40 barrels and brought that into our Rick House. And we think it's something that we're really, really proud of. It's 36% rye. It's 5 and 6 year old barrels. We use about 5 barrels. We select the 5 barrels out of the 40 that we have. We put it in a bottling tank. We run it through a small paper filter to remove just a little bit of the barrel bits. And we don't chill filter it. We don't carbon filter it. We bottle it 99 proof. And one of the things that we wanted to be real clear on is that this is not something that we make. There's so much of that in the market where I don't really think there's a whole lot of truth in advertising and truth in what's really going on. And we took sort of a different approach with Old Scout. So on the side of the label, it actually says that this is a curated, or hence the name Old Scout, sort of a scouted whiskey. So that's pretty much the gist of Old Scout.
Where will it be available?
It's available now. We brought a little bit out in West Virginia about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And we really launched over the last week in D.C., Maryland, Florida, New York, and Connecticut.
I've received a sample of Old Scout. I'll have tasting notes for it later on in this episode. Also on the bourbon front, in case you haven't been watching the news, there's a presidential election in the U.S. coming up in 2012. Heaven Hill is releasing a pair of new election-themed bourbons. Red State Bourbon and Blue State Bourbon are both bottled at 40% ABV and will be available pretty much nationwide. Of course, Red State and Blue State refer to the tendencies for states to go either Republican or Democrat. Heaven Hill will be tracking sales of both bourbons during the 2012 election season to see whether bourbon preference and voting patterns go hand in hand. Now, here's a trivia question for you. Where did the idea of so-called red states and blue states come from? They weren't originally the official colors of the parties, but several decades ago, the Gallup poll started identifying states as red or blue on national maps during its election season polling based on whether a state was leaning Republican or Democratic. The concept caught on and continues to this day, and now you know the rest of the story. In other news, the Dalmore has released a new 1995 vintage single malt. It's been aged in a combination of Methusalem sherry and American white oak casks. Just 1,800 bottles are available exclusively through the whiskey shop stores in the UK. As you'll hear in a few minutes, Glendronach did extremely well in this year's Malt Maniacs Awards. The distillery is releasing 5 new single cask bottlings this month, including a 39-year-old single malt from 1972 matured in an Oloroso sherry butt. The other 4 range in age between 18 and 32 years old, with maturation in either Oloroso or Pedro Jimenez sherry casks. Finally, let's finish up with a couple of new books that might make good holiday gifts. Glenfarclas is celebrating its 175th anniversary with the publication of Ian Buxton's History of the Distillery. Glenfarclas, an independent distillery, is available through the distillery's website. You might be able to find a copy through Amazon as well. Meanwhile, the Irish Times invited readers to contribute short stories earlier this year. More than 3,000 were entered in the competition. Powers Irish Whiskey has picked the top 40 to publish in a new book called Celebrating What Truly Matters. Proceeds from the book will go to the Irish Hospice Foundation. It's available at Eason's Booksellers in Ireland and through singlepotstill.com worldwide. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Speaking of holiday gifts, there is still time to order prints from the WhiskeyCast website photo gallery and get them in time for the holidays. Not much time, though. The deadline to order for Christmas delivery is December 13th for North American orders and the 8th for international delivery, and that'll be cutting it close. These prints will add a special touch to your whiskey room, home, office, or bar, and we've cut the shipping prices to a flat rate anywhere in the world of $10 for one print and $20 for 2 or more prints. You'll find them at the WhiskeyCast website, whiskeycast.com. Let's check the inbox now for the comments of the week brought to you this time around by Highland Park. Tom Burrows emailed me on last week's feature on the future of the Stitzel Weller Distillery in Louisville. Here's what he had to say. Hi, Mark. I had a chance to listen to the most recent podcast earlier today, which focused on the Stitzel Weller Distillery and its history. It was asked a few times during the interviews about whether the distillery would be reopened at some point in the future. David Driscoll, the spirits buyer for K&L Wine Merchants in California and writer of the K&L Spirits Journal blog, had an opportunity to interview Preston Van Winkle and posted the podcast on November 17, 2011. Preston mentions that the main reason the distillery won't reopen is a pretty serious asbestos problem requiring millions of dollars to properly renovate the facility. This concern, as well as Diageo's reputation for making sure their mothballed distilleries stay that way, makes me fairly pessimistic about a reopening happening anytime soon. It's an interesting interview and something I recommend for anyone interested in the Pappy releases and history of the company. I appreciate what you're doing and look forward to listening to many podcasts to come. Have a great holiday. Thank you very much, Tom. I have mentioned the asbestos problem at Stitzel Weller in the past, and that was one of the reasons why my tour of the facility was limited to the office area. Diageo doesn't let guests into the still house for that very reason. However, it is a problem that could be resolved if someone makes the decision to spend the money. Had a lot of suggestions after I mentioned a couple of requests last time around for help finding good whiskey stores and bars in the Denver area. Jason Peckman and Jonathan Oddy both recommended Applejack Liquors on the city's west side, as well as Pints Pub, which I mentioned last week. Jason also recommended the Whiskey Bar, the Bull and Bush, and the Rack House Pub, which is attached to the Stranahan's Distillery, and occasionally may have one of the Stranahan's Snowflake releases available. Jonathan also suggested Scruffy Murphy's and the Horse Brass. along with his family's new whiskey bar, the Burns Pub, which will start a whiskey dinner series on January 21st. Thanks for the suggestions, guys. Good luck with the new pub, Jonathan. Finally, as I was working on last week's episode, I mentioned on the Facebook page that I was tasting the 1976 Highland Park that I mentioned last week. Had a few comments responding to that, including my favorite one posted by Quentin Hodgson. Very simple, eloquent, "You lucky bastard." No arguments there, my friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or something you'd like to get off your chest, well, go ahead and post it at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Or if you're not on Facebook, you can just go ahead and email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. And the comments of the week are brought to you this time around by the folks at Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you, as always, by Laphroaig. Maker's Mark continues its holiday candlelight distillery tours through December 10th in Loretto, Kentucky. McTeers will hold an auction of rare whiskeys on the 7th in Glasgow. Bonhams will hold one in New York City on the 8th and the 14th in Edinburgh, Scotland. Fred Noe will preside over a tasting of Beam's Small Batch Collection bourbons at Mac McGee's Irish Pub in Decatur, Georgia on December 15th. The Astor Center in New York City will hold a class on making whiskey cocktails on January 13th. And the Victoria Whiskey Festival is coming up January 20th through the 22nd in Victoria, British Columbia. I'll see you there. Don't forget to join us for a special episode of WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings to be recorded at the festival. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Billy Lighton, Master Blender, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
The sherry butts in particular have a big impact on the flavour of Redbreast. It gives it the deep, dried, fruity notes, which is probably the signature of Redbreast. Take a sip, hold it in my mouth for minutes, and just dissect it and pick up all the little fruity notes. There's something that I didn't notice before. Whenever you leave your glass of Redbreast sitting there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you can go back to it and go, "Oh, something's changed there. Why is that changing? How is it changing? Is this something that I should be picking up on?" You know, it's fascinating. And I mean, I've been in the business 34 years, and it still excites me, you know, things like this.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
Time now for WhiskeyCast In Depth. The Malt Maniacs released the results of the 2011 Malt Maniacs Whiskey Awards on Thursday. If you're not familiar with the Maniacs, it's an invitation-only group made up of 34 serious whiskey lovers from around the world, including folks like Dave Broom, Charles McLean, Serge Valentin, Martine Nouet, Davin DeCergamo, Ho Cheng Yao, and others, including myself. Each year, a group of the Maniacs' so-called amateur members, those who don't write about whiskey for a living, make up the jury for the Malt Maniacs Awards. Distillers, bottlers, and distributors are invited to enter the competition for free. All it costs them is the whiskey and shipping. The jurors pay all other costs for the competition, including having their samples shipped to them all over the world. It may also be the toughest competition to win a gold medal in. I was not on the judging panel this year, but discussed the results with Maniacs Keith Wood in Germany and Krishna Nukala in India.
First of all, let's talk about the overall awards, because this year the number of entries appeared to be down a bit, but the quality appeared to be just as strong as last year of the entries. Is that fair to say, or am I wrong on this?
Krishna?
I think, yes, you're right. Keith is right, right?
Yeah, I think what you say there, Mark, is really very true. But don't forget, we actively went out of our way to try and reduce the number of entries from last year. last year saw a whopping, I think it was 262, wasn't it? And that was just too much for the judges to handle in a short space of time.
Krishna?
Yeah, yeah. The last year there were 262, and actually three guys dropped out in the middle. So we thought it will be too taxing on the people, and also time limit is short because you have to taste two times to get a perfect rating.
I know that I spoke on various occasions with Johannes in the lead up to this, and we kind of agreed that somewhere round about 170 to 175 would be an ideal number, and we were absolutely delighted in the end with 171 entries.
And there were some real crackers in this one too, weren't there?
There were indeed. There were some magnificent whiskies, and it's all too easy to look at the absolute top of the range and say, wow, they were great, but all the way through the three categories there were some absolutely stunning whiskies.
Let's talk about the eight that actually got gold medals, because this is a far lower percentage than most other competitions. Eight out of 171 got gold medals. Were you surprised by the eight that actually received gold medals? Because it seems like we had a couple of distilleries that dominated the top eight this year between Glendronach and Strathisla with some very old whiskeys.
Actually, it is not so. Last year also, we had about 12 gold medals out of 263, and this year, 8 out of 171. The percentage remains the same, if you see the total number of gold medals that are awarded. And Glendronach last year also won the top award. So I'm not really surprised. The only surprise I thought was the Yamazaki Sherry cask. That 48% also could have got a gold medal. So that is a little surprise for me. But others are fairly well placed.
From my point of view, Mark, I think I agree with Krishna that you will find the actual percentage of gold medals is not really any different from last year. But to answer your question about the stunning whiskies from one or two distilleries, again, I think that's quite similar to last year. Glendronach did very well last year as well, if I'm not mistaken. And they are magnificent whiskies. There's no doubt about it.
And the key to this, that all of eight of these gold medal winners were independent bottlings. Does that say something about what the distilleries are releasing or what the independent bottlers have been able to acquire over the years?
I think it says something about both of those. First of all, the distilleries are releasing some of their top stock to the independents, and the independents are getting even better with their cask selection, if you ask me.
Yep.
And I need to correct myself a little bit, because the top three, the two Glendronachs and the Crew Azawa, were both distillery bottlings, but they were single casks, of course. But the other five that received gold medals came from Adelphi, Gordon and MacPhail, and Wilson and Morgan.
That's right.
For me, the Adelphi has always been a very, very good independent bottler. And when they came out with this Log Side, I mean, that was just better than anything I've tasted from them before, and I've tasted some exceptionally good stuff. I have no idea where they've been hiding that one, but my goodness, is that a beauty.
I was not a judge, but I got to try that one during a tasting in Glasgow at an Adelphi tasting for Glasgow's Whiskey Club, and I agree with you, that was a stunner. I was not surprised to see that at the top of the list.
Because Krishna and myself had done the filling from the original bottles, we knew that was there. But once the samples were filled, then the originals were away, and we were both tasting as blind as anybody else. And to be quite honest, when I looked at the scores afterwards, and I just could not believe this blended whiskey, you know?
Absolutely.
We need to explain, this is not your typical blended whiskey, because it's a single blend, because Log Side at that time was producing both pot still malt whiskey and column still grain whiskey under the same roof at the same distillery, and this was a blend of both of those. So this is not your typical blended scotch. This is a very unique blended scotch, sort of, I guess, what they're calling a single blend.
Single blend.
Yes, I think. Right. I think I agree with you totally there, and yes, they were producing those two, and this is purely a single distillery blend of their own single malt and single grain.
Let's go to the awards, at least, for the six awards that go out in each of the three categories, the ultra premium, premium, and the so-called daily drams category, and let's start off with the daily drams. The Non Plus Ultra Award, or the overall winner in that category, was the Lagavulin 16. Obviously not a surprise there. That wins awards almost every year, if I remember correctly.
It's a magnificent whiskey. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Lagavulin is always a champion stuff. So it never fails.
And the same can be said almost for the Talisker 10, which won the Best Natural Cask Award.
Well, to be quite honest, I was a little bit surprised, because I'm one of those people of the viewpoint that Talisker used to be a magnificent 10-year-old, but the quality perhaps dropped off in recent years. But everything I tasted here, when I look back at my notes that I made now during the blind tasting, it tells me that Talisker 10 is right back on the top again, where it used to be. And that, for me, is very, very good news.
Krishna?
Yeah, yeah. Talisker 10 is absolutely, is always a fantastic whiskey to taste. Absolutely good whiskey.
The Best Sherry Cask Award was the Glenfarclas, which was a distillery bottling of, I guess, a 9-year-old, a couple of casks. The legend on this is kind of hard to read. What do you guys filled this one? What do you know about this bottle?
Well, this bottle was submitted by a chap in Germany. So my understanding is it's a distillery filling, but basically for one specific German outlet. It is indeed two casks. It's cask 1575 and 1576. It was, from my own notes, it was a fantastic Glenfarclas. It had all of those typical rich Glenfarclas depths, but it also had quite a complexity of some light aromas and flavors in there as well. It made it really quite unusual, but equally stunning.
And then let's go to the Best Cask Innovation Award, the Aberlour 16-year-old Double Cask Matured. This was an unusual bottling too, right?
Yes, it was. And it's also...
It will be, yeah.
It also surprised me a little bit, because in my mind, Aberlour is normally very, very rich and very heavily sherried. And in this particular one, the influence of the non-sherry cask really came through there. And it had plenty of vanilla and light notes in there. Very, very unusual and absolutely worthy of a Cask Innovation Award.
And
absolutely, Mohakid. Actually, I remember this tasting this, and I see from the points, I am the one who gave 90 points to this. I'm the only one who gave the highest to this. And if I look at my tasting notes, it was a really brilliant whiskey, and lots of sherry stuff and lots of dried fruits I have noted in that.
Then the Best Peated Malt Award didn't really go to an Isla distillery, at least as far as we know, because it went to the Big Pete from Douglas Lang, which is one of those bottlings that doesn't name the distillery. But having had that before, that is a real cracker of a peat monster, isn't it?
It is indeed. And may I just correct you there? You say they don't name the distillery, but they actually do.
They do.
Big Pete in this case. It's a blend of single malt from Ardbeg, Kalila, Bowmore, and Port Ellen.
I stand corrected.
Yeah.
And to be quite honest, I tried the previous release of Big Beat, and it was good. But this one is a cask strength release, and the cask strength makes all the difference. It really puts it up there. And now I know the result, I'm really not so surprised about it.
Turning to the Thumbs Up Award, this one went to the Kilhoman Spring 2011 release, a fairly young whiskey.
Yes, it is. This is really another case of one of the new kids on the block putting his whiskey out there and absolute quality, absolute top quality. I've not yet had a bad bottling of Kilchoman. And this particular one, it just gets better and better every time.
And we saw that from a bunch of the young guys, from the Kilchomans, the Amruts, the Penderins of the world, the really young distilleries, along with the Campbellands. We saw some really good performances among these younger whiskies overall, right?
Yes, Mark, actually, just now I put a small mail in our internal group that the younger new guys like Kilchoman, Amrut, and Kavalan, they are very bold and enterprising to put their young whiskies to the against the giants like all other established whiskey distilleries in Scotland and Japan. This is very, very interesting to see. Very, very appreciating on their part.
And while we're talking about Amrut and the little guys, we should talk about the premium category. And in this case, let's start off with the Best Cask Innovation Award, which was the Amrut Porto Nova, which involved some port cask maturation. This was an unusual one. And Krishna, please answer this for me. This is one that Amrut is not generally available in India, correct?
Yeah, Amrut, they cannot sell in India because of excise problems, a lot of tax issues and labeling issues in various states. And it is easier for them to export than to sell in India.
But it didn't surprise you that this one was an award winner, right?
Absolutely. Actually, I tasted this Amrut Porto Nova in the distillery in August this year when I went there. And it was really a stunner. At that time itself, I told the distillery manager, Mr. Surinder Kumar, that it is by far the best Amrut I ever tasted. And I also told him that this will create a lot of waves in Europe and United States and Canada. And that really, actually, in blind tasting, I'm very, very pleased to find that I scored the same score as I tasted in the distillery. This is not only me, and several others liked it very much. They put into high into 90s, and this is very, very nice to see it.
Keith?
I totally agree with everything Krishna said. And in my opinion, we started off here by talking about basically the younger whiskies, the new kids on the block. And for me, Amrut are fast becoming of age. I mean, they're a fantastic distillery. The word innovation suits them to a T, and they just get better and better.
Let's go through the other awards in the premium category. The non plus ultra, or at least the peak in the category, was Suntory's Yamazaki Sherry Cask, which was a very interesting whiskey that's not exported generally much outside Japan, except a little bit goes to Europe, right?
As far as I understand, yes. And the individual types of cask that Yamazaki produce are absolutely stunning. The Sherry cask was magnificent. For me, as well, the Mizunura cask was equally good. But yes, we're talking about the Sherry cask. It had a magnificent depth of flavor. It had that complexity, and it was just a very, very good Sherry cask. And it would hold its own, as you've seen in the competition, against any of the other sherry casks on the market.
Krishna?
That's right, Keith. Actually, this Yamazaki sherry cask, when I was tasting it blind, it actually reminded me of the winner of 2006, which was Yamazaki 20-year-old, but that was 56% strength. And actually, in fact, in my tasting notes, I wrote this as a twin brother of winner of 2006.
The Best Natural Cask Award in this category goes to Lagavulin again, but this time for the 12-year-old natural cask strength, which was a distillery bottling at 56.5% ABV, which for a Lagavulin is usually something you don't find very often, right?
That's correct. And what they do now is each year they tend to produce a special edition 12-year-old cask strength. And I certainly remember last year's was a stunning whiskey, which I enjoyed in the back of a van with a few whiskey enthusiasts driving through Scotland.
As a matter of fact, I am looking at my sample bottle of that one here from last year. This was part of last year's special releases, and I'm going to have to give this one a little special attention later in the evening. But turning to the best sherry cask, Glendronach gets another one for its 17-year-old 59.2% sherry cask that was bottled for Taiwan. What can you guys tell us about this one?
I was very, very pleasantly surprised here. It is a magnificent whiskey. It's absolutely superb. And for me, again, looking back on the notes that I wrote blind, but I now know what it is, and I'm really, really surprised it's a 17-year-old. It tasted much older than that to me, and it's yes. just got a fantastic character for that specific age. It's amazing.
Actually, I think this time there are four Glendronachs, and it is surprising to see that I have given 90 to all the Glendronachs, and this one I gave about 92 points. I totally agree with Keith that I really thought it was really highly aged whiskey, more than 17 years, perhaps around 25 to 30 year old. But when the result came out 17 year old, I was very, very surprised. And there is another one, Glendronach, which is 12-year-old. That was also fantastic stuff.
We probably ought to clarify at this point, because we've talked about Glendronach a lot. There is a limit on the number of entries that a distillery can enter, three bottlings, correct?
That's what I understand, yes.
But there again, you can also have independent bottlers or independent distributors in countries like Taiwan who enter the bottles
exactly.
that they imported in as well. So we had some entries come in from Taiwan and some other countries of whiskeys that would have put a distillery over its limit had the distillery entered it. So we need to clarify that just to make sure everybody understands what happened there.
Yeah, that's correct. As you say, this was a bottling for Taiwan and sent by the Taiwanese distributor.
Now, you mentioned Adelphi earlier, Keith, and they won the best peated malt in this category for the Breath of Isla 12-year-old. This was 56.1%. Another cask strength bottling. We seem to see, the maniacs seem to really appreciate cask strength bottlings, in my opinion.
I think it's not just the maniacs. I think in general, whiskey enthusiasts are moving towards the more cask strength or the higher ABV values. The one perhaps regret that I have with the whole Malt Maniacs Awards is the fact that we don't know the ABV whilst we're sampling the whiskey. And sometimes, although you can tell that a whiskey has a high ABV, if we knew what it was, then I'd be more tempted to try the sample a few more times with water, because that can just do so much for the whiskey as well.
Right. Krishna?
Yeah, I agree with him, because we really don't know what is the ABV that is being tasted. And in most of the times, many people nowadays are going for cask strength whiskies, because the complexities that come out of cask strength whiskies are far more than the normal bottlings.
Personally, I think it's a matter of you can add, but you can't take it away. So when you're buying cask strength, you have the option of adding your own few drops of water and bringing
exactly.
it into your
exactly.
own taste preferences. Whereas if you buy a bottle at 40 or 43%, you can't take the water away.
And we should go to the Thumbs Up Award, which was a heavily peated whiskey, but not from Isla. It's Suntory's Hakushu heavily peated, a 48% bottling. And this, again, another very unusual whiskey. You don't see a lot of heavily peated expressions coming out of Japan.
I think I agree with you there. It was an unusual whiskey. And when I look back on my notes at this one, the word smoke appeared quite often. But the word peat only really appeared in my description of the finish or the aftertaste. I found this a very good, very interesting whiskey, but for my palate, I wouldn't have said it was heavily peated. I would have said it was heavily smoked. And I do tend to make the difference between what I would call a wood smoke and a peat smoke.
Right.
And for me, the peat really came through in the finish on this one.
Krishna?
I really don't remember what actually I taste, how I am treating it, because I don't have the notes in front of me. But I think I gave it around 87 or 88, and I seem to have identified it as a normal Isla whiskey, but I didn't find it to be any Japanese whiskey.
Mark, if I can just come back to part of your original question.
Sure.
About the fact that you don't see so many of these heavily peated whiskies coming out of Japan, you're actually quite right there. I can only immediately really think of two, and a few years ago, Yamazaki did a very, very heavily peated, which again was just massive on the peat and the smoke influence. I really think that they are there. They should produce some more because they're jolly good when they do.
Before we get to the ultra-premium category, I want to turn to Krishna for a second here, because you made a very long trip up to Keith's place just outside of Munich, Germany, to help with the bottling for this. I want you guys to tell me about the experience of taking these 171 bottles and then decanting those down into 14 blind sample bottles for each of those I know, Keith, at one point you said you had an entire pallet of bottles in your house at one point, right?
Yes, that was the first big shock that I really got. As you know, Olivier down in Alsace has done the distribution for the last few years, and I was speaking to him when we agreed that I would take over for this year, and of course, we all swap samples with friends. We all know what a few sample bottles look like. And it really, really come home to me when Olivier just turned around and he said, "You do realize we're talking about a pallet of glass." And sure enough, a whole pallet of 3,500 sample bottles was delivered into my garage, and then I moved those into the house. So, yes, absolutely.
And by my count, it took about 2,400 just to fulfill all the samples. So you still have a whole bunch of bottles around your house, right?
Yes, I do, because we were guessing on around 200 entries, plus giving a little bit of contingency. So we allowed around about 220 per juror. And yeah, in the end, I rounded it up, ordered the 3,500, and I've still got around 1,000 bottles hanging around. Absolutely.
So it's a head start for next year.
Yes, indeed.
Krishna, what was it like going up to Germany to do the filling?
Actually, when this awards process started around June or July, when Olivier said that he cannot do it because of this global warming, and it was magnanimous for Keith to come forward and offer himself. Actually, Ho Ching also offered that he can do it in Taiwan, but because of the logistics simplicity, we thought that Keith would be a better person. And because I have been attending this filling award ceremony in Alsace, in Olivier's place, I knew the logistics and the difficulties. So immediately, I thought I can help out Keith in doing the things. And personally, also, it is a little bit easier for me to fetch the samples myself than to subject to customs in India via post. So that was another reason I told that I will join Keith, and it all went on very well. And it was a nice thing that Keith offered me to put at his place. And the labels, what I found was the labeling of the empty samples was the most difficult part. You have to label 2,565 labels on the sample bottles. And it took the whole day. It's really, okay, it's a fantastic experience.
How much spillage was there?
I think I dropped two in the towards end. Two small bottles, two small samples.
Two sample bottles were knocked over, and there was a total spillage of around 4 cl or 40 milliliters. So,
that's right. Maximum 50 milliliters.
Given 171 bottles and all the sample bottles only spilling 40 centiliters is an accomplishment, guys. You did well.
Not 40 milliliters, Mark.
What?
It was 40 milliliters.
Oh, 40 milliliters. I'm sorry.
And I have to thank Keith's friend Gareth, who actually chipped in for 2 days. He stayed with us, and without him, he came as a man Friday to us. It was a great help from Gareth, who is Keith's friend there. And of course, Abhinay, who helped in getting the bottles when Keith was not around the home. That was really good.
I think I need to say at this stage that compared to previous years, we had a very, very small filling team. So we had to utilize the time to the absolute maximum, and to only literally have 4 people at any one time maximum working on this. It was astonishing. I was totally surprised but delighted that we finished this literally within around 2.5 days total.
And that's the thing most people don't realize about this competition is it is all volunteers. The Maniacs do everything themselves, from collecting the samples, filling them, sending them around, and the judges all paid for shipping their own samples and getting them shipped to them. So it's this is not just an academic exercise and where the distillers are essentially paying entry fees. This is a fully volunteer project.
Absolutely. Totally 100% volunteer. And as you say, any costs involved are shared between the jurors, the Maniacs themselves. So the sample bottles were paid for by us, and all of the postage. Now, as I was sending them from Germany, postage within Europe was relatively cheap. But think of the poor guys in Taiwan and Singapore, that they were paying nearly 200 euros just for postage for the samples.
And I have to point out that the one time I was a juror, I think in 2008, Krishna's brother hauled my samples over, if I remember correctly. And I met him at Newark Airport. He brought about half of my samples over. I had brought about half of them back from Whiskey Live Paris. And your brother was kind enough to pick up the rest and bring them with him when he was flying back to the States. And I met him at Newark Airport as he came out of baggage train with this big box.
That was in 2008, Mark.
It seems like such a long time ago now. I haven't been able to judge since then, but I envy you guys for being able to do this. It sounded like a lot of fun this year. In the ultra-premium category, the Non-Plus Ultra Award went to that Glendronach 39-year-old that we talked about earlier, one of the Glendronachs that just was a stunning whiskey, right?
There were actually 2 Glendronach 39-year-olds submitted, and they were both stunning. But the Ultra Non-Plus Ultra Award going to Cask 712, that was just a really quite unbelievable whiskey. When I, again, because I received the bottles, I did the filling, I knew what kind of competition this one would have. In that absolute top class, there were some fantastic whiskies. And for any one of them to shine through like this above the rest in the way that the Glendronach Cask 712 did, it just stands up head and shoulders. Magnificent and absolutely, truly stunning.
And this was a stepsister in some ways to the other Glendronach 39, right? There were very similar casks. I believe there was related to last year's winner too, right?
Yes. Actually, I thought it is a back-to-back winner. In fact, I was confused like how we are giving the same gold medal for the same whiskey. But when I thought, read over it for the last year's sample bottle with this year, they are different, actually. It is actually a back-to-back winner.
Now, the Best Natural Cask Award also probably is the oldest whiskey in this year's competition. It was bottled by Gordon and McPhail for the Dram Takers and was a Glen Grant 59-year-old distilled back in 1952.
That's correct.
Krishna, what can you tell us about this one?
Well, we knew that there was, whenever myself and Keith were bottling, we saw it and we were really stunned by that bottle. And ultimately, when it was sampled and the sample came to us, it is, when we tasted it, Actually, when I look back to my tasting notes, I wrote it is excessively wood but not obnoxious. That's what I wrote.
Keith?
I'm just amazed at the age of this. It is a natural cask, but the color of it, I mean, it is almost what I call treacle toffee. It is so dark, it is so luxurious, and such a fantastic creamy mouthfeel. But what was surprising here was, if I had have tasted it not only blind as you understand, but totally blindfold as well, so I couldn't see the color, I would never have guessed such age and such depth, such darkness of color. Because at the same time, this also had some extremely light and floral elements. It was a really quite unbelievable whiskey.
I have noticed, having tasted some 50-year-old Glen Grant before and some older expressions, Glen Grant is one of those distilleries that, for some reason, just it seems to get better the older it gets, and it's not subject to that real woodiness that a lot of casks develop after 25 or 30 years, but you can push a Glen Grant 35, 40, even to 50, and in this case, 59 years, and it still comes out very vibrant, very floral, and really holds up well with age. And I don't know what Dennis Malcolm is doing there, but I hope they keep doing it for a long time.
Absolutely. I can only agree with you there. It is one of a few distilleries that really do age in this way.
And this is from Gordon and MacPhail.
And Gordon MacPhail just has this knack for picking really good casks too. We've got to give them credit. They, for some reason, when they're getting these filled, they just seem to get the pick of the litter as far as getting casks filled at the distilleries.
This is, I'm not sure if you're aware of this. I mean, the label does point out the dram takers, but this is one of a range of whiskies called the Book of Kells, which is a series from La Maison du Whisky in France, and they specialize in a whole range of very old whiskies. But having said that, this is the oldest one that I've seen as yet from that.
And they may still have a few bottles of that available, if I remember correctly.
I believe so.
Let's go on to the
Mark,
best. Go ahead.
Mark, can you excuse me? I have to take a flight now. Can you carry on with Keith?
Yes, we'll carry on. We'll say goodbye to Krishna at this point. Krishna, again, thank you for your work on this year, and we do appreciate it. And thank you for taking a few minutes with us. We'll continue with Keith now. Safe travels.
Sorry, Mark, because I have to really rush up. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you, Keith. Safe to you.
Take care, Krishna.
And we are continuing with Keith. Let's go to the Best Sherry Cask Award. The Kuruozawa, essentially a 30-year-old. It was a 1981 Kuruozawa, and this, again, is one of those whiskeys that you get from Kuruozawa and Number One Drinks Company. They just seem to come up with some stunning whiskeys every year, and it's a shame that we're not seeing Kuruozawa in production anymore.
Absolutely. Again, I can only agree with you there. Fantastic, stunning whiskey. It was the first one of this age that I've tasted from them, and it certainly won't be the last.
We talked about the Lochside 46-year-old earlier. That won the Best Cask Innovation Award. The Best Peated Malt Award went to a Port Ellen. Not surprising, but what is surprising is that it's a cask strength bottling from Wilson & Morgan, the Italian bottler.
Yes, Wilson & Morgan do some very, very good bottlings, but I haven't really come across a Port Ellen of this age from them before.
And I hope we come across more of them from that age. There's not
absolutely
many left, because this was 1982, so there's not much more stock left in the pipeline after 1982 Port Ellen.
I'm sure stocks are indeed running down, and sadly so. This really, really was a very, very good whiskey, and Wilson & Morgan should be extremely proud of this bottling. They really should.
And the Thumbs Up Award was the essentially a 41-year-old Strathila from Gordon & MacPhail that was distilled in 1970, bottled at 43%. Only 514 bottles came out of that cask after 41 years. I'm not surprised, but tell us about this one.
Gordon and McPhail again, isn't it, with their cask selection, and the leftover stocks they've got hidden in those dark corners of the warehousing. Lovely, lovely whiskey. But there again, I am a fan of Strath Isla. Even the younger Strath Isla have got such a vibrant quality, and this one, even at this grand old age, really showed an awful lot of that typical Strath Isla vibrancy, of the complexity, a mixture of rich flavours and also the lightness that really, really makes a great whiskey.
Now, there was one other award, and the Maniacs do this from time to time when a whiskey stands out for one reason or another. And I want you to try to explain this one to me. It's called the Pressure Cooker Award.
Our Pressure Cooker. Yes.
The Macduff 10-year-old, bottled for exclusive malts for Taiwan. It was distilled in 2000, bottled at 56.6% ABV. Tell me about this one. How did it come to be a pressure cooker?
Well, as I look at my own notes, I talk about the richness, the depth of flavor, the amount that's in there. That this is one very, very big whiskey. I can really only call it big. And it's as though it's being quite literally pressure cooked to get so much out of a whiskey that is only 10 years old. That is the key behind the name, the Pressure Cooker Award, that we came up with. It is just a massive, massive whiskey for that reasonably young age. We talked earlier about not thinking some of the others were quite so old as they were. In this case, it's totally the converse. This one could easily be passed for 15, 20 years old. There is so much in there, and from one so young as well.
Let's talk about the medals real quickly, because the Maniacs have a different standard than almost any other competition. If you don't get at least an 85, the best you can do is a bronze medal. And in a lot of competitions, 85 would get you a gold in some cases. Let's go. I want to just read a list of some of the whiskeys that got bronze medals, which means they averaged below 85 points in the average judging among the 14 Maniacs who were judging. We're talking Springbank 18-year-old, which a lot of people would consider a classic in many ways. Kilbeggan's 18-year-old. The Boonahaven 12. Looking through the list here. The Glenlivet Nadura. The Hakushu 12-year-old. The regular Glendronach 12-year-old only got a bronze medal.
Those
17. I'm sorry?
Those are still great whiskeys.
Oh, yeah.
They're very, very good whiskeys. And if you look at it, they're scoring anywhere between 80 and 85 points. Now, that is a very, very good score. It is absolutely not to be sniffed at. It's not a degradation in any way whatsoever. But as you said, we Maniacs, we do things in a slightly different way. And the idea behind the medals is to, let's say, verify the quality of the whiskey. So it's not surprising that such a high percentage of entrants actually receive a medal. It's because we're saying, yes, this is a very good whiskey. It is of that level or it's of that level. But then beyond the medals, that's when the individual awards for, shall we say, the best in class come in. But yes, the medals, we do things differently. The medals are a confirmation of absolutely high quality whiskey. Now, for me, this is not a negative point. It's very, very positive, because it means the industry as a whole, from the small independents, the large independents and their cask selection, and of course the distilleries themselves, must be doing something right to actually be able to maintain such consistently high quality.
Were there any whiskies or any new whiskies or new bottlers or new distilleries even that we're seeing for the first time this year that we really ought to be watching for, because they made an impression this time that we're going to want to see in the future?
Well, I'm not sure about new this year. Certainly new to me, and I think they were also entered, some of them were entered last year, people like Kavalan. I was totally astonished at the quality of those whiskies. They will stand up against anything else in the competition quite easily. Talking about surprises, for me, we've spoken about the Adelphi blend. Black Bull also submitted a blended whiskey. That was a magnificent whiskey. But right down, I won't say not the bottom of the scale, but right down in those daily drams and in the cheaper end of the daily drams, it was astonishing to find the everyday blends like Cutty Sark. They did magnificently well. They are very, very good whiskies, unbelievably so. And the value for money that one gets when one goes out shopping for these is just incredible.
I know that Cutty Sark has spent a lot of time over the last year or so reformulating the basic 12-year-old, and they're reformulating all of their blends. So it's good to see that that's getting some recognition, especially among the maniacs, who generally, as a rule, tend to be called malt maniacs for a reason. But to see them give a score like that and give a bronze medal to a basic blend like Cutty Sark is very, very good to see.
Yes, indeed. And it is, again, vindication of what they're doing with the Cutty Sark brand.
And it's not just the 12-year-old. The 18-year-old Cutty Sark also got a bronze medal.
Very, very nice whiskey, yes. Very. It's what I would call an everyday whiskey. Very smooth, very approachable. An anytime whiskey, for sure.
Were there any whiskeys that didn't do as well as you would have expected?
Very, very good question. There were quite a lot of Bunnahaven entered in the competition. Now, they did reasonably well, but one or two of those, I thought they would be right up there with the Glendronach 39, but then just not quite. But I don't think that's anything against Bunnahaven. I think it's just, again, coming back to the quality of that Glendronach, standing head and shoulders above the rest of the field.
And I should point out, looking at the score sheet, the Bunnahaven finished, a 1979 Bunnahaven for Barry Brothers and Rudd, the Barry's own selection that was bottled for Taiwan, came out literally half a percentage point from making a gold medal. It was in.
Yes.
It was one of the runner-ups, and then a 31-year-old Bunnahaven was about a point and a half away. There was, again, an Adelphi bottling. So it's not like those were scoring really low, it was just that they were within a point or two of making gold medals, as was a 42-year-old Bunnahaven that was a Wilson & Morgan bottling again.
Yeah, another magnificent Wilson & Morgan bottling. It really was. They're doing something very right at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, and so we shouldn't take this as a criticism of Bunnahaven. These were three independent bottlings that all, but for one or two scores, could have easily been gold medal winners.
Absolutely, and as you say, literally just a case of one and a half points away from being top of the class.
You can find the complete list of medal winners and the score sheets for each judge at maltmaniacs.com. There's a link at the WhiskeyCast website. Time now for the What I'm Tasting This Week department, brought to you this time around by the Glenrothes. Keith and I were discussing old Bunnahavens, and I'll start with one that was not entered in this year's Maniacs competition. It was bottled by Duncan Taylor for the Rare Old Series, and is a 32-year-old Bunnahaven distilled back in 1979 and bottled at 47.1% ABV. The nose is buttery with light wood smoke and just a hint of peat, toasted oak, and a touch of lemon underneath. The taste is buttery smooth with citrusy notes of lemon peel, spicy touches of ginger and allspice, and a hint of almonds. The finish is lingering with a touch of lemon peel. I'm scoring the Bunnahaven 1979 from Duncan Taylor's Rare Old Series a 90. Now, the latest release from Sweden's Macmyra Distillery is dubbed Hope, also known as Special Number 07. It's a single malt bottled at 45.8% ABV, and matured in first fill casks previously used for maturing Swedish cloudberry wine. The nose is light with notes of fresh berries, juniper, dried banana chips, and a touch of butterscotch. The taste is tart and tangy with lemon-lime notes, banana and coconut, fresh berries for a touch of sweetness, and a bit of black pepper spiciness. The balance is excellent. The finish also has a great balance of berries, citrus, and juniper. I'm scoring the McMurra Hope a 92. Finally, we heard about Smooth Ambler's Old Scout Bourbon earlier in this episode. Once again, it's a 5-year-old high rye content bourbon bottled at 49.5% ABV. The nose is warm and spicy with notes of cinnamon, toasted bread, caramel, brown sugar, and dark chocolate. The taste is thick and spicy with cinnamon, ginger, dark chocolate, and molasses notes. And the finish is long and warming with a lingering cinnamon touch. I'm scoring Old Scout Bourbon an 88. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you this time around by the Glenrothes, where maturity matters, not age. Find out more at theglenrothes.com. The Glenrothes also brings you the free WhiskeyCast app for iPhone and iPad. Our free app for Android is brought to you by Ben Romick. You'll also find my tasting notes at the WhiskeyCast website, along with links for our Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the photo gallery, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. Support for WhiskeyCast comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to receive your own personalized whiskey journal. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.